Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Halloween night brings out the little witches, cute as buttons. But we all know there's another side to the witch story, a long and dark history of witch hunting. American witchcraft scholar John Demos says that story is longer and darker than you may know. And by his reckoning, it's not over. This hour, On Point, the never-ending story of witch hunting. You can join the conversation. Do you know how deep this story goes? Are we over-obsessing with black magic and sorcery, or still ready, one way or another, to hunt witches? Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is John Demos. He's a professor of history at Yale University. He's written extensively on witchcraft and witch hunting. His new book is The Enemy Within, 2,000 Years of Witch Hunting in the Western World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Demos, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me on.
I want to just thank you right off the bat for a wonderful book. This is absolutely fascinating. It puts witch hunting in a broader context and with more detailed tellings of more kinds of stories than I had ever quite imagined in this category. You know, I wish you'd start off with what many people may hear as an unlikely witch hunting story that goes all the way back to Rome. It's the first one you tell, and you describe it as the Martyrs of Lyon, in your telling, you have early Christians in the role of witches, but that may sound odd to a lot of people. I wish you'd introduce us to the story.
Well, it seemed odd to me when I first came upon it. This group of Christians in second century France in the town of Lyon, who were increasingly and then terribly persecuted by the Roman leaders of the town. In those days, Christianity was considered to be a kind of marginal sect, a branch of Judaism. And was the subject of a kind of anti-Semitic notion, and then of an anti-Christian idea. So these so-called martyrs in Lyon were indeed rounded up and persecuted, and finally many of them were killed, as in fact were Christians in other parts of the Roman Empire at around the same time too. And I thought it was kind of an interesting irony, in a sense, that in this long history of witch hunting, which mostly cast Christians in the role of witch hunters in the later Middle Ages and so on, that at the very beginning, in a sense, it was the other way around. The Christians were on the other end as targets of a witch hunt.
Give us some of the detail that makes you put this in the category of witch hunt and not simply martyrdom, as it might have been sort of traditionally described. What were the elements here, the details that jumped out at you and said, this looks familiar, this looks like a witch hunt?
Sure. Well, I think the bottom line, the sort of root source of witch hunting in almost every version is deep fear, exaggerated fear, which leads people to a position in which they just want to discover and then root out this enemy that's lurking within them. And that's very much the story, I think, of these early Christians. They were, many of them, members of, or at least had been for a time, members of the regular way of life there in Lyon. And then I think many of them had become converted, perhaps fairly recently, to Christianity. So there grew, among other Lyon people, the sense that there was this alien presence among them that hadn't been there perhaps before and that threatened the stability of their whole culture. And all of that is very reminiscent, I think, of what came later on in the name of traditional witch hunting. The idea, in sense that there, in a sense that there is this conspiracy that's gnawing at the entrails of the community, and that if something is not done to root it out, you know, the whole world will be turned upside down.
Christian disdain, Christian clannishness, Christian proselytizing, all you say looked like conspiracy to those Romans, but also teachings and rituals cast in sort of witchy terms. The Eucharist, communion, described as flesh-eating. Agape, the notion of a kind of a deep religious love, described as sexual perversion.
Exactly so. Yes, I think that's true. And in the attitude that develops around witch hunting, it's very much the case that practices which may seem or seem to the people involved with them quite innocent get turned into something else by those who are deeply fearful.
Some of these were prosperous. Most were modest in their social position. Some were slaves. What was their fate?
Well, most of them were rounded up and brought into a kind of coliseum, a forum, where they were subjected really to, first to questioning, I think, very, very severe questioning. And then some were tortured in order to get them to confess their terrible deeds. And finally, some of them were thrown to the lions, and as happens sometimes in the late Roman Empire, that was one way of doing away with people, I guess. Many of them were killed. I don't think it's known how many, but certainly probably dozens and dozens were killed.
You don't call this the first witch hunt by any means, but definitely not the last. What was the height of European witch hunting? When did it come historically?
Well, there is a moment in the second half of the 16th century when there's a tremendous upsurge of the witch hunting impulse. Up to that point, all through the Middle Ages, there had been a kind of low level and occasional matter of witch hunting. Certainly everybody believed in that possibility. Everybody believed in witches and witchcraft. But in the late Middle Ages, as I say, the late 16th century and on into the 17th century, there was this huge upsurge of witch hunting all across the continent of Europe and in the British Isles as well, whereby thousands and thousands of people ultimately were rounded up, were put on trial, were convicted, were executed. We don't know, actually, the total numbers. Historians have tried to figure this out. It used to be thought that the total number of people killed by in what came to be known as the Great European Witch Craze, it used to be thought that the numbers were in the millions. We now have scaled that down to something more on the level of 100,000 or so, and that's still a very large number, and way out of line with anything that had happened before. So this witch craze, so-called, lasting a little over a century, I guess, was something very, very special and distinctive in the history of the West and of witch hunting. Even though witch hunting has existed both before and after, there's something about that period that made it that just greatly increased its scale.
There was a key text that lay behind a lot of the thinking that led to the great witch craze or the great era of witch hunting. Describe that to us.
Well, in the late 15th century, a couple of Catholic priests published a book in Latin, which they called the Malleus Maleficarum. That roughly translates into English as the Hammer of God. This book was a kind of a large compilation of all sorts of beliefs and practices having to do with witch hunting. You could call it almost a Bible of witch hunting, or maybe a better word would be an encyclopedia of witch hunting. Many stories of witchcraft included within it, and kind of detailed instructions as to how to discover and prosecute witches, and a lot of earnest exhortation to people to really take this matter very seriously and sort of upgrade their witch hunting efforts. This book was published in the 1480s. Well, actually, one of the earliest books to be printed. The printing press itself had been invented only a few decades before. And it was widely circulated. Many, many editions in Latin were published, and then later on editions in many other languages as well. And people all over Europe, and for that matter across the ocean in the American colonies as well, owned this book, read this book, and took it as a kind of guide for witch hunting.
How did they define what a witch was? And how much of what made a witch was someone who was still practicing rituals, rites, habits?
Pre-Christian rites.
Pre-Christian, that were still kind of overlapping.
Yeah, well, historians have long worked with that possibility that a good deal of pre-Christian, I guess we might say pagan ritual and belief had survived, and this was now being picked up as and called witchcraft. I think on the whole, that notion has been pretty well set aside by the scholars most closely involved. I think it's more, I think much of it just has to be understood as fantasy, this idea that witches and witchcraft were widely prevalent in one's own immediate surroundings. The suspicion tended to go toward people who were more or less on the margins of the community, people who didn't fit in very well, people who had called a kind of unfortunate attention to themselves with some of their behavior with neighbors and others. I think people who, by the standards of the time, seemed a little too free to give vent to their anger were sometimes picked up this way. Witchcraft charges often followed a quarrel between neighbors and then something going wrong. And then, who knows, maybe that was caused by, maybe the fact that my cow died last week rather suddenly and strangely was caused by the witchcraft of my neighbor, who I know doesn't behave well and doesn't like me anyway. That's the way things would begin to get going.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Halloween, we're talking about the long history of witch hunting and what it tells us about human nature and human manias, maybe. My guest is John Demos, professor of history at Yale, author of Entertaining Satan, Witchcraft and the Culture of Early New England, and now author of The Enemy Within 2,000 Years of Witch Hunting in the Western World. John Demos joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. You've got a wonderful list in the book on page 90, John, which I guess is a kind of, I'm not sure what you call it, folk remedies or prescriptions for warding off witchery. I wonder if you could introduce it and read a bit for us there.
Yes, this is from a document in the 17th century that is associated with the early history of the colony of Pennsylvania. And it's a kind of set of prescriptions of do's and don'ts having to do with witchcraft. Okay, here's the list.
Okay.
Quote, a cross should be cut into a broom to prevent witches from writing on it. A psalm book should be placed below the head of the newly born child to prevent its being exchanged for a changeling or elf child by the evil spirits. Bleeding is stopped by grasping around the sore with the hand and repeating the formula, thou shalt stand as firm as Jordan stood when John baptized in the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. When a cow is sold, a bunch of hair should be taken from her and preserved to prevent the good luck from leaving the house with the cow. A little of each course from the Christmas table should be taken on Christmas morning and given to the cattle to preserve them against witchcraft. If milk is accidentally spilled into the fire, salt should always be thrown in to avoid misfortunes. If the spinning wheel is kept going after 6 o'clock on Saturday evening, the sheep will not prosper. That's the list. Let me just say that yes. I think one of the nice things about this list is that it suggests how the belief in witchcraft was really part of a much larger range of beliefs having to do with magic and the supernatural. I mean, not everything on that list directly relates to witchcraft, but this was a time and a place where the supernatural world just stretched across a broad expanse and included much that was good and positive, as well as much that was bad and evil and witchy.
So have you come then in all your study to see this fear and the pushback against it as kind of a pre-science, floundering by humans trying to explain things there was no science to explain? And, the world could be very tough on them. They're looking for answers and lashing back against the supernatural because they didn't have a way of scientifically, understanding what was going on?
I think in the pre-modern and pre-scientific world, witchcraft could be a very useful way of explaining things that otherwise seemed awfully troubling and hard to understand. It was convenient in some ways to be able to identify a source. That way you kind of were able to lower your own tension level, your own confusion level, and find maybe a way to strike back. You could do something instead of just sitting there while these unhappy things happened.
And there was this phrase that cunning folk, those who I guess tried to wield some of the supernatural, were they always necessarily? What did it mean, cunning folk? And were they necessarily seen as witches?
No, they were not necessarily seen as witches. Cunning men, cunning women, both genders in this case, mm-hmm. Were thought, I think, existed to a degree in perhaps almost all pre-modern villages in Europe and in the British Isles. This was a person who was thought to have a kind of special line, as it were, to the supernatural, who was able to practice certain kinds of small rituals and say magic words and so forth, mostly to help out people who were in trouble. At least that was the general idea. If you were sick in some strange way, or if you'd lost something and couldn't figure out where it could possibly have gone, go to the local cunning man or woman, and maybe he or she could help you resolve that problem. Now, sometimes these cunning folk were thought to kind of cross the line from good to evil, so to speak, and to engage in witchcraft themselves. So occasionally, a suspicion turned against them, and they could even then become the targets of a witch hunt.
And here we just heard that whole list of remedies or ways to ward off witchery. A cross should be cut into a broom to prevent witches from riding on it, and that centuries ago. Let's turn to our listeners. Eugene in Woodbury, Connecticut. Eugene, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I teach medical history. Huh. At the University of Bridgeport, and one of the things I found fascinating is why they think that witches rode their brooms. And from my reading of a book called Plants of the Gods by Richard Evan Schultes, he's one of the most famous ethnobotanists around.
Okay.
He would say that the witches would apply hallucinogenic salves of hyoscyamus, which is henbane, belladonna, and mandragora, mm-hmm. to their cervix, to sort of initiate an altered state of consciousness. And often when these herbs are used, they would give the sort of the idea of flying to people. So, and I know that there's actually a picture of wood carving of this in Dr. Schulte's book. So I just wanted to share that because someone mentioned about the carving something in the broomstick, and it's interesting where the whole witches riding on the broomsticks originated.
That's a pretty wild image. Hallucinogenic applications right where the broom goes. What do you say, John? What do you know about that image?
Well, I know that this theory about the salves and the unguents that they supposedly put on themselves is out there. And I can understand, I guess, at least in a loose sense, the scientific basis for this idea. The trouble is that almost everything we know about witches and witchcraft comes mm-hmm. from the people who thought themselves to be targets and victims of witchcraft. So we don't really know anything about what so-called witches, those who were accused, actually did, whether they did anything of this sort at all. It's conceivable they may have. But
they left no record. They wrote no books.
They wrote no books. They just protested their innocence for the most part. Some of them confessed, but usually only under great duress. In fact, under extreme torture. Mm. So I think most of the evidence that might be connected with the actual practice of witchcraft is actually seriously, at the very least, filtered, and I would say irreparably compromised by the source. Mm. So, you know, the idea that witches flew through the air, were there some people who thought that they flew through the air? Possibly, but what we really know about this is that their victims, quote-unquote victims, believed that they flew through the air. Whether there's anything more to it than that, we just don't know.
Eugene, thanks for your call. John Demos, take us then to the hunt. You define this very broadly. You take it all the way up to the McCarthy era and to some of the child abuse sex cases in very recent history that turned out to apparently be unfounded. But take us to what an example or two of what you would consider from the pages of history classic witch hunts, and give us a sense of the dynamic that illustrates what you've seen unfolding.
Well, maybe we can take the example of Salem, since it's the most famous case of all, and say a little bit about that. In Salem, beginning in the early months of the year 1692, a small group of mostly teenage girls began to behave strangely, to experience what people at the time called fits of affliction that were caused, or so people thought, by witches. And in fairly short order, these girls began to accuse individual members of the community, mostly women, not entirely. At first, a couple of sort of marginal figures, outliers in a sense, but then increasingly respectable members of the communities, and it began to really just spiral up enormously. And that spiraling aspect is really central to all of the big witch hunts. Once it gets going, it generates its own kind of sort of internal momentum, and one accusation leads on to others and so forth and so on. So and that's the way it goes. If we try, many people, historians and others, have tried to find explanations for what lay behind something like the Salem witch hunt, and they span a broad range. In my book, I try to go through quite a list of, I think, more than a dozen. But one thing we can say right off is that a place like Salem in the 1690s and the surrounding communities as well was very much on edge, in a state of high anxiety, both about difficulties that were kind of internal to its own community. In fact, there had been a kind of, you might say, almost a kind of warfare for control of the town going on between different factions for quite a number of years, and about literal warfare with Indians up just to the north of Massachusetts. So it's a place that's really on edge, that is really where you're likely to find this kind of thing happening.
Was the scale of accusation there unusual? Or when you look across the whole history, do you find many instances where you have multiple accusations at once, a kind of a group, a big roundup like that?
The scale was much greater than for any other colonial American witch hunt. There had been, and this is not, I think, widely understood, but there had been small-scale witchcraft hunts and witchcraft cases all through the colonies, the American colonies, almost from the time the first settlers stepped on these shores. It was just part of everyday life to believe in witches and worry about witches. But it was only at Salem that this terrible spiral developed, when one thing led on to another and really a whole community became convulsed for months at a time.
And what about the scale in Europe before?
Well, in Europe it was greater still. In the so-called witch craze years, you can multiply what happened at Salem many, many times over. Sometimes it happened in large communities and spread from one good-sized town to another. So there, instead of having a few dozen people involved, you might have had hundreds or thousands.
Give us an instance on that scale.
Well, there were cases in southern Germany. Southern Germany is perhaps the single most powerful venue for witch hunting. And there were places in southern Germany where, for instance, the authors of this book we mentioned a few minutes ago, the Malleus Maleficarum, went around from one town to another in Germany and sort of organized witch hunting, got lists of people who were thought to be suspect, and again it would go on and on until finally it would pretty much exhaust itself.
Let's go to Ide, calling from Roanoke, Virginia. Hello, Ide. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Ashbrook. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Ide?
What I know is that the persecutions still go on today, just on a much more sophisticated level. My family is practicing witches. We're not out of the broom closet, as they say, because of the persecutions we've seen some of our friends go through. They're sophisticated in ways that suddenly they'll have Child Protective Services show up. suddenly jobs disappear, loans through local banks get denied very quickly. Those kinds of things still happen in some of the small towns, especially where there's a very large Christian unit that likes to work against someone who's not exactly in the box.
When you say that your family are practicing witches, what exactly do you mean by that?
We are earth-based religions. We keep the Sabbaths. We have our prayers, our meetings, and rituals, if you will, almost like Christians, just with different names and different styles.
And is this Wiccan? Is that the right word for it? Are you?
Yes, we tend more towards Wiccan. My husband and I, and of course, again, we're not out because my husband's very high up in the community, and he could very well lose his job. Three of our children are out, and they are Wiccan. Three of our children are staunch Christian, and one of our children is actually interested in Buddhism.
Is this very unusual in your part of Virginia or not?
It is much more usual than people know. It's things that are kind of kept to yourself. But again, you have to be careful. Some of the younger people are not as careful as the older ones. They haven't come up against some of the discriminations that the older ones have.
Did you begin life Christian? Were you raised Christian? I mean, how did you become a witch?
Well, it's sort of been a family tradition in a kind of backward way. In our family, we had stories of a couple aunts who practiced, always with the moral of how when they were dying, they reverted back to Christianity. I believe that was the moral for us not to follow their footsteps, but the stories were always told all the time. When I was in the sixth grade, I found a book on the very top of a library shelf in our library about witchcraft that I took out and checked out as a kid, read, was terrified that I was going to go to hell, but found it very interesting, very fascinating, and the tolerance was what I was looking for. And just started from there.
Does Halloween mean anything special to you, witch-eyed?
It does. Yes, it does. Halloween is a new year for me. It's also a wonderful time to remember those who've passed. Supposedly the veil is thinner between the here and now and the afterlife or afterworld, between the worlds. And it's also my husband and I's anniversary. It's very important to us.
I don't know if I've ever spoken with a witch before, but I appreciate your calling in. Thank you very much.
John, I believe you have. You just probably don't know it.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Thanks for calling, Ide. John, you kind of, as you become more contemporary, you stretch your definition of witch hunting to, as we said, McCarthy, Fells Acres, the sexual abuse case, and so on. Ide says, hey, wait a minute. There's still real or self-identified witches out here who face discrimination.
That was a very interesting call. I certainly know or have tried to find out a good deal about modern-day practice of witchcraft and Wicca. I do want to say that I think it's basically a very different thing from old-style witches and witchcraft pre-modern times. For one thing, nobody in pre-modern times would have announced himself or herself to be a witch. There was no kind of—I mean, that would have led quickly, probably to the hanging gallows. There was no sort of group activity that anybody, among so-called witches that one can. It was really, I mean, I have to say, I think it was mostly a matter of fantasy in those who felt themselves to be attacked by witches. And as nearly as I can tell, I did quite a lot of reading about Wicca and modern day witchcraft practice. As nearly as I can tell, it's a kind of invention of the early to mid 20th century. It is, as your caller said, an earth-based religion.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Halloween, we're talking about the long history of witch hunting and what it tells us about human nature and human manias, the Harry Potter theme behind us there. My guest today is John Demos, professor of history at Yale University and author of the new book, The Enemy Within, 2,000 Years of Witch Hunting in the Western World. You can join the conversation, How Do You Explain Witch Hunting? And does Harry Potter's popularity mean we're over the phobia of witches, or that it's just been prettied up for a while? And what about John Demos's wider definition of witch hunt? Was McCarthyism just as much a witch hunt as the Salem witch trials? John, what about Harry Potter and the way it's kind of, you know, all gussied up and prettied up and extremely popular among millions and millions of young Americans and others these days? Does that mean that attitudes have changed, or is this something else entirely?
Well, I think witches and witchcraft are no longer anything like the subject of the, you know, the object of fear the way they once were. So Harry Potter and Halloween itself becomes basically an occasion for fun and amusement. But that certainly is wildly different from the situation in pre-modern times. When we talk about witch hunting today, we do, I think, move over into a sort of different sector of life. We talk about political and red scares and other kinds of social scares that have been with us, dotted through really our whole history up to virtually the present day.
So you make the link, though, with that very broad definition then. How do you define, or how do you describe the social, the psychosocial explanation for why this happens? What's going on in a witch hunt?
Well, I think basically, again, it's grounded in a climate of fear, when for one reason or another, people are extremely worried about the possibility that they will be overwhelmed by evil forces that emerge finally within their own midst, within their own community. I mean, I called the book The Enemy Within very deliberately because I think the within element is crucial. There are other kinds of terrible things, of course, that happened in the world. And, you know, one could think of the history of lynching or the Holocaust or a variety of other such things, all of which I think bear some dynamic relation to witch hunting, but are different in that the enemy in those cases is basically identified as being without, as being on the outside more or less from the start. Racially different, ethnically different, religiously different, and that is a difference. Because, again, with witch hunting, the enemy looks just like oneself. The witch is very hard initially to discover because he or she is so similar, and yet he or she has this hidden connection to the devil or whatever, which makes for a terrible threat.
Or that's the narrative line that gets wrapped around it. Here's an interesting question or comment from the website, onpointradio.org. It's from Edwin saying, not much discussion here about the anti-feminist aspect of this topic. Did the rise of witch hunting in the Middle Ages correspond with the rise of the cult of the virgin? If so, might it not follow that the female witch was the dark twin of the spotless virgin? Witch hunting seems to reflect a global cultural strain of treating women as either pure or diabolical. What do you say, John Dewey?
Wow, I say I wish I'd put that in my book. That's just beautifully and powerfully stated, and I think it's basically right on target. We haven't, in our conversation so far, mentioned the fact that the vast majority of accused witches were female. So there's a gendered aspect of this that is fundamental to the whole subject, at least of traditional old-style witch hunting. That was true, the predominance of women as targets, that was true at Salem, that was true in other cases in early America, it was true in the great European witch craze, and it's true in a whole range of non-Western cultures, which anthropologists have studied around the world. Witchcraft appears, the belief in witchcraft and some degree of witch hunting appears in almost every culture that we know anything about. It's a darn near a universal phenomenon.
With the woman as the most frequent target.
Yes, to come back to that. I mean, the woman, the details can vary enormously from one cultural and historical setting to another, yet this one element is almost always there, the predominance of women as targets. So I think, finally, we have to think in terms of some very deep substrate of misogyny in human character, in the human psyche, almost, which presents itself in these different situations. And it's important to get this element straight, because this misogyny, such as it is, exists, I think, in women as well as in men. And that corresponds to the fact that we have to recognize the fact that many of the witch hunters were themselves female. It wasn't just a sex war in which men were putting down women. Many women were right out front as persecutors of so-called witches.
Let's get a call from Plainfield, Vermont, and Mish. Hi, Mish. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
To continue the discussion of breaking out of the American and European focus
on
witchcraft, there is a current problem in much of Western Africa that has received newspaper accounts. Children age 5, 6, 7 are being murdered for money by what I would call criminal preacher frauds, who conspire to accuse the children of witchcraft. And the children are physically abused and then, in some cases, murdered.
What countries are you reading about, Mish?
This has been documented for several countries in West Africa, and without referring to the newspaper accounts, I don't want to give wrong information. Guardian Weekly out of Britain has had extensive reports on this, and that is available online at guardian.co.uk.
John Demos, how about it?
To bring that out.
Yes, thank you. Mish takes us right out of your Western, deliberate and explicit, and acknowledging that there's more, but out of the Western world framing into Africa, and describes an entirely current problem there.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about this current problem, I think a newspaper article or two, but I really don't know many of the facts. And I'm not sure that it sounds easy to correlate with witch hunting as I've been trying to study and write about it. If children are the primary targets, that in itself suggests a line of difference, because the targets in all of the witch hunting I know about were basically adults of one sort or another, mostly female, as we were saying. So this sounds to me like a terrible thing, but something that's not exactly the same.
But when you look over the lip of Western culture and into others, people may well be wondering, has the same pattern been there, whether it's in Asia, Africa, Mesoamerica?
I think there is a kind of fundamental prevalent pattern in all these different situations. There's tension in the community. There's a wish to identify a source. Typically, it turns out to be a woman of a certain age. One of the flourishes here is that it's not necessarily elderly women, as we come to think, in Ray of Halloween and so on. In most of the old-style witch hunts, both in Europe and America, it was women in middle age who were suspected. That's the primary demographic, to use modern terminology. But children, that would be very rare. I mean, I've seen exceptional cases, but I think they truly were exceptional.
Women in middle age, have you thought of why? Why? Because they were at the height of their powers as people, as women at that age, or...?
They were at the height of their powers, and they were just on the verge of, or had just lost, one of their most central powers, which was the power of reproduction. I think a lot of the thought and feeling that swirled about witchcraft and witches in olden times really had to do with fertility. Witches were thought to strike particularly hard at fertility. They sometimes made women barren. They sometimes made men impotent. They interfered with the care of very young children. They frequently interfered with breastfeeding infants. They could attack the crops as they grew in the field. So there is another kind of fertility issue. And middle-aged women, as they approached the menopause, were, in a very vulnerable place, and felt themselves in some ways to be vulnerable.
Here's a news story out of London recently. It says campaigners in London plan to petition the British government today, I guess, for a posthumous pardon for the hundreds of people executed for witchcraft in the UK between the 16th and 18th century. They describe about 400 executed in England for alleged witchcraft, many more in Scotland, the campaigners are saying. And the Witchcraft Act of 1735 put a formal end to trials of accused witches. In England, many still face persecution in jail for other crimes there. Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont, and Matt. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is about midwifery and witches. My understanding is that medical doctors were often called at these witch trials to be expert witnesses and helped in that persecution process. And I'm wondering what the guest thinks today, to what degree the medical group's persecution of midwives as a profession is an extension of that relationship.
Interesting. The medical doctor of the time versus the midwife of the time, John D. Moss?
Well, I'll back up to get a little running start here by saying that I think it's true that in pre-modern times, midwives were more likely than, say, women at large to be suspected of practicing witchcraft. And that also relates to the kind of fertility complex that I was suggesting a minute ago is at the root of many ideas about witchcraft traditionally. You know, today, I'm not sure kind of how to whether there really is a good connection back to those times. I understand there is some tension between the medical establishment, fully certified physicians, and midwives.
But that would cast this as a kind of science versus pre-science to the extent
right.
that science had
that's
emerged.
Right.
And that also is a kind of gender battle in a way, with men dominating the new science.
That's absolutely true. Well, there was some tension between physicians and midwives in pre-modern times as well. However, I'm not actually aware that physicians played much of a special role in the prosecution, the persecution of witches in the 16th and 17th centuries. They were occasionally called in to examine a young girl who was having fits that were possibly caused by witchcraft. And in such cases, they would be asked, does this look like a matter of this problem she's having? Could it be from natural causes or not? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the physician would say, yeah, it is from natural causes, and you forget about witchcraft. And sometimes he would say, oh, I can't explain this in any way that I'm familiar with, so perhaps it is an evil hand. They would use language like that.
Maybe to cover their own ignorance.
Maybe to cover their own ignorance. That's true.
Let's get a call from Boston and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, I used to live in the North End, and I passed a plaque once called In Memory of Goody Glover. Apparently she was a midwife, and when I went on the tour, historical tour, I think she was accused by cop and matter and hanged, but some children of a prominent family broke into sweats, and then what it later said is that she and her husband, who was Scottish, was sent into the islands like Barbados or Jamaica by Cromwell, and when she came to stand on trial, she only addressed the court in Gaelic.
A story out of the North End in Boston and Goody Glover, John Dimos.
Yeah, that's indeed a bona fide case. It happened just a few years before Salem, and I think the Salem witch hunt, and I think helped set the stage in some sense for the Salem witch hunt. I think she was an Irish woman, actually. I've never seen that she was a midwife. She was known to be a washerwoman. Mm-hmm. She got into a dispute with some of her neighbors about work she was doing for them as a laundress, as a washerwoman. They claimed she had stolen some of their clothes, I think. And one thing led to another, and this quarrel kind of spiraled up until finally it was decided that maybe she was a practicing witch and that she had caused fits in the children of this neighbor family who had accused her of stealing their linens. And she was tried in Boston. She could only speak Gaelic. I think they had to use an interpreter to examine her. She was convicted and she was executed. So that was a kind of important early case for sure.
Goody Glover.
I didn't know about the plaque in the North End. I'll have to go look for it.
There you go. Take a walk. Let's get one more from Corinth, Vermont. Blanche, you're on the air. Our time is short. What do you know, Blanche?
What do I know? I know that Nicholas Bailey and his wife Margaret, who are my relatives, came over and they were in the New Haven colony. And she got brought up on witchcraft. It turns out, reading the records from the New Haven town records, she simply had a big mouth. And she had an opinion about everything. And they kept asking them to brought them into court several times, and finally they had to leave the colony, and they went to New York City, where they had a much better life. But they were harassed fairly regularly, and he would make up excuses. But apparently the real problem came when one of their animals was trying to copulate with an animal of a different nature, and she said, "Well, so what?" That was it.
And that was enough. Off she was kicked from New Haven, and you're a direct descendant, I see here, Blanche.
Yes, yes.
Our time is short, but let us pick it up, John. That's down in your neck of the woods.
That's one of the early New Haven cases. Luckily, they got away, that couple. And I think the caller has described some of the details that are actually versions of that are present in all of these early witchcraft cases. And the other thing I'll say is it's amazing as I go around and give talks and so on about this subject, how many people are descended from witches or witch hunters. I myself am descended from witch hunters, not witches.
In Salem, you're a forebear.
That's right. That's right. My family, the Putnam family of Salem, were really forefront persecutors of witches in Salem. So one way or another, many of us have some connection, it seems.
We've just got half a minute. What does it take to escape this, or do we ever? Is this part of human nature?
It just goes on, and it's hard to say. In the very last paragraph of my book, I tried to raise the question of whether we can even imagine a world without some form of witch hunting. I think the only thing to say is, you know, we just got to be on the lookout for this tendency, both in ourselves and in the world around us. The most important thing is to choke it off just as it's getting started, because then if it does get going, it has this kind of internal momentum that builds up. Very hard to stop after that point.
John Demos, author of The Enemy Within, 2,000 Years of Witch Hunting in the Western World. He joined us from the studios of WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor Demos, thank you very much for being with us today.
I'm a longtime listener of the program, Tom, and it's great fun to be on the other side. Thanks a lot.
What wonderful to have you. Happy Halloween, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.